Well, good morning, everybody. So, we're gonna start with a dedication. And dedication. We dedicate our time together this morning to all those who are suffering. May we remember that our suffering and well-being are shared. We acknowledge the Dakota and Anishinaabe peoples on whose traditional, ancestral, and contemporary lands clouds and water is an uninvited guest. For those of us who are not indigenous to these lands, may we commit to curiosity and engagement with the lives, justice movements, and sovereignty of the Native nations of this territory and beyond. We offer deep gratitude for our Indian, Chinese, and Japanese spiritual ancestors and contemporaries for all they have given us and for the chance to be here today. May we practice cultural humility. We recognize the Black community and the destruction of the Rondo neighborhood in the neighborhood we practice. May we stand side by side in community care. We are all connected. May we work together for the liberation of all beings. I wanted to say something that my husband Dwayne and I last Sunday afternoon had the opportunity to go hear Jim Bear Jacobs, who is an indigenous man who has done tours of sites around town of places where indigenous people lived and were sacred to them, and also places where they were gathered together in difficult situations like concentration camps. And Jim, we were at Fort Snelling, and Jim spoke for like an hour about many of the different things that historically happened to the indigenous people in Minnesota. And I would like to encourage people, if they haven't had the opportunity to experience and learn about this history, to look up Jim Bear Jacobs. That maybe about 15 years ago we did these Bearing Witness retreats here that were organized by Honor You Laura Kennedy, and they were amazing, and we gave indigenous people the opportunity to speak their truth and for us to listen. And I needed a refresher course myself, and I would like to just encourage people to look up Jim Bear Jacobs, because he does wonderful things.
He's Reverend Jim Bear, isn't he?
Oh, is he Reverend?
He's with the Minnesota Council.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He's with the Minnesota Council on Churches, so that's how you can find Reverend Jim Bear.
Okay, thank you for that clarification. No, disrespect intended. So, and I also, because it's Mother's Day, would like to dedicate this talk. Am I okay here?
Yeah.
Okay. Talk to all our mothers, including those who have been in the traditional role of mother, as well as all the others in our lives who have nurtured, cared, and loved us throughout our lives. I'd especially like to dedicate our practice to those who are doing their best to take care of their beloved children in tragic conditions of illness, famine, and war. You are seen. The mother-child relationship is one of the most intimate that human beings can have. You are so appreciated. So I wanted to say something about my own mother. So, my own mother died 27 years ago on Mother's Day. And so, for a long time, Mother's Day was very bittersweet. And now, it's much more bitter than sweet. That my mom experienced cancer 3 times, twice in her 30s, and then it's what did her in her 70s. She had breast cancer. And throughout her life, although she dealt with these illnesses, and with having 4 daughters, who were quite a challenge at times, I'll say, she was kind and generous. And she was there to help others. She helped many, particularly women, through their cancer journeys. And that's part of her transmission to me, and I try to emulate those things. And her other transmission to me that was handed down to her from her biological mother is this gene, this BRCA gene that has an inclination towards breast cancer and ovarian cancer. Mm-hmm. And so she was a good example to me of how to be in the midst of dealing with this illness. And I always appreciate her. And 27 years later, and probably till the day I die, this time I miss her deeply, and tears come to my eyes. But then there's so many other times I think of her with a big smile on my face. So, thanks, Mom. Thanks, everybody's mom. Okay. So this morning, I would like to speak from case 3 of the Gateless Barrier. Gutai raises 1 finger. And so I'm going to be using this book that was translated with a commentary by Robert Aiken. And so if you bear with me, I'm going to do a bunch of reading of this case. Case. Whenever Gutai was asked a question, he simply raised 1 finger. One day, a visitor asked Gutai's attendant what his master preached. The boy raised a finger. Hearing of this, Gutai cut off the boy's finger with a knife. As he ran from the room screaming with pain, Gutai called to him. When he turned his head, Gutai raised a finger. The boy was suddenly enlightened. When Gutai was about to die, he said to his assembled monks, "I received this 1 finger Zen from Tian Lung. I used it all my life, but never used it up. With this, he entered into eternal peace." Wu Man's comment. The enlightenment of Gutai and the boy was nothing to do with the end of a finger. If you can realize this, then Tian Lung, Gutai, the boy, and you yourself are all run through with a single skewer. so we can all be in this together. So I'm going to read a bit about who Gutai was and is. Okay. So he began his practice in conjunction with his Zazen when he was a young monk living in a little hut by himself. Solitary practice is not, this is Robert Aiken commenting. Robert Aiken Roshi, excuse me. Solitary practice is not so unusual. From time to time, I meet people like Gutai who at a certain place in their lives prefer to do Zazen alone. This, as Gutai himself learned, just a phase. One day toward evening, a nun named Jisai appeared at his hut. Yamada Roshi translates her name as True World, an interpretive rendering that is quite interesting. The Chinese ideographs could mean either true encounter or true boundary. So Yamada Roshi is implying that Jisai presents the most vital quality of human life as well as its extent. True World did not knock or call out when she arrived, but just walked in. It was probably a one-room cottage. Traditionally, such cottages were just 10 feet square. There was Gutai sitting in Zazen right in the center. Without taking her off her sedge hat, she walked around him three times and then stood before him saying, "If you can say an appropriate word, I will take off my hat." Circumambulation is a ritual found in traditional societies all over the world. In Zen Buddhism, it is an act of self-presentation by a pilgrim to a teacher. It is then followed by three bows to the floor and other procedures. True World did not observe the proper ritual, however, and Gutai was unable to respond. He seemed dumbstruck. So True World walked around him three times again, stood before him and said, "If you can say an appropriate word, I will take off my hat." Again, he was unable to speak. She repeated her performance still a third time. Silence. So she turned on her heel and walked out. When Gutai finally came to himself, he went to the door after her and called out, "It will be dark soon. Why don't you stay the night?" She turned around and said, "If you can say an appropriate word, I will stay the night." He still couldn't say a word, so she left. Gutai was downcast. He felt he had been defeated by True World and thought, "I am going about this matter of finding realization the wrong way. I need a good teacher." He packed his gear and then, because it was dark, sat nodding over his pack, waiting for the dawn. Suddenly, the tutelary deity of the mountain appeared there in the dark and said, "Don't leave. A great Zen master will come here soon and you can consult with him." So Gutai unpacked his gear and waited. Sure enough, in a couple of days, Tianlong appeared. Okay. We can learn from Gutai's mistake. He had probably fantasized, "I will attain the heights with my own genius and inspiration. I won't be bothered with trying to deal with the world of contradictions, the world of malice and misunderstanding, difficult personalities, and arguments. I am just going to sit here in purity and recite my Dharani and do my Zazen and let the world go by. The world would not go by. It intruded, in fact. He couldn't deal with it. He realized to his credit, I've been making a mistake. I now see that I must interact, and through interaction I can find realization. I must search out a good teacher. I must re-enter the world. With that decision, he was abruptly assured from his own inner depths that a teacher would come to him. He made himself available. Sure enough, Tianlong appeared. That was the second visit of the true world, another incarnation of the woman. He engaged Tianlong in a crucial dialogue and was enlightened. Gu Tai was right in wanting to devote himself to his practice. We need Zazen, lots of Zazen. When I assure people that 10 minutes of Zazen a day is the minimum, I am speaking with some irony. But Gu Tai's mistake was in supporting that lots of Zazen is enough in itself. It isn't. Even a small amount of Zazen can be bondage if it is a device for avoiding the world. It is an engagement that we find our true nature, the true nature of the universe. Pretty wonderful. So in the koan study group I'm a member of, we were having, about 3 weeks ago, we were having a conversation about ritual and our practice. The person speaking was said that there's some Zen centers that have let go of much of the liturgical practice, not seeing the value of it. Perhaps it's seen as performative. It can be that if it's approached, it can be that way if it's just approached on the surface. So it's difficult to know what we're giving up if we don't even see what it is, to delve into what it is it's like. Looking at a plate of food and saying, I don't like it without tasting it, you know? It's judgment before experience. So it's difficult to know what is being, as I said that. Scratching the surface isn't very satisfying. So committing to something means being open to having it penetrate our whole selves, which is what Gu Tai was realizing, that he had to open himself up to experience everything around him, to let it penetrate within himself. And he knew that he needed some help. This can be true of most of our activities in our daily lives. How do we relate to whatever it is we're involved with? So, when Gu Tai's attendant was pointing the finger at the moon, emulating his teacher's action, he had no personal connection to this pointing at the moon. And, you know, he was mimicking his teacher without really understanding what his teacher was conveying. So it was kind of an empty gesture. Thus, Gu Tai cut his finger off. Well, You certainly had a connection to that gesture and felt it fully. And so when Gutai looked at him and put his finger up as the attendant was going out the room screaming, there was a moment of clarity. And he could see that Gutai is pointing his finger at the moon. Kind of really didn't have a whole lot to do with his finger or the moon. It had to do with, from my point of view, with the relationship of Gutai's finger and the moon and his whole, Gutai's whole being and interaction with the moon. So some of you have heard this story from me, but it's been a while since I've told it. So when I was a young practitioner at MZMC, I was fortunate to be part of a Tenzo group. So at Minnesota Zen Center, if you haven't been there, there's a kitchen on the first floor, and there's a back stairway that goes from the second and second floor down through the kitchen and out the back door. And so one day I was finishing up on a Saturday morning. We had a Saturday morning practice and had breakfast and stuff. And it was probably a day not unlike today. And I just was ready to get out of there and be gone and was thinking about my next activity. And so I was kind of grumbling, sweeping the floor and finishing up. I was just like not very into it. And so here comes Roshi down the stairs, and he looked at me and looked at my situation, and he had a big smile on his face, and he said, "I feel sorry for you." And I've had a lot of time to contemplate that story and contemplate what that meant, and I've come to the conclusion that he was sorry for me because I just couldn't be with the activity at hand of being completely with sweeping the floor and what I was doing, to be just in that moment. And so I'll tell you, ever since then, when I sweep the floor, I go back to that moment and I'm with the sweeping floor. So, Gutai's attendant, when he was pointing to the moon, it was kind of a performative thing, and he wasn't in that activity. And there's this song that I'm not going to sing, but I'm going to read the lyrics. Dwayne's here and he would tell me not to sing. But, you know, when I was growing up, I was like into Broadway musicals and movie musicals, and so this was from The King and I. And so Anna, who was like the tutor and governess of the king's, she was the governess of the king. I can't remember if she was the governess of the king's child, or I don't remember the story completely, but she was speaking to a young person. And she said, I can't, I have to sing it, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Go for it.
In my out-of-tune voice. Whenever I feel afraid, I hold my head erect and whistle a happy tune so no one will suspect I'm afraid. While shivering in my shoes, I strike a careless pose and whistle a happy tune, and no one ever knows I'm afraid. The result of this deception is very strange to tell, for when I fool the people I fear, I fool myself as well. I whistle a happy tune, and every single time the happiness in the tune convinces me that I'm not afraid. So alright, so this is about putting yourself in a place, creating a container to change your point of view and change where you're at. So I think in the 12-step tradition, many people use the phrase, fake it till you make it. And so sometimes we're in that situation. Oftentimes we're in that situation when we're just not in the mood for whatever it is we're supposed to be doing. We're not in concert with the activity that we're called to perform. Perhaps there's a sink full of dishes to wash, or we need to wake up and go to the zendo early in the morning because we're the doan or the doshi. What compels us to just do it? So I have to do another aside here. So I wrote this all down, and I realized in my kitchen this morning there was a sink full of dishes. So I took a pause, and I went and I did the dishes. Listen. How can I not do the dishes now? Just do it. And so I went and I did the dishes. And so for me, initially, some things might start out performative. People are allowing me to fulfill a particular role. The dishes are counting on me to take care of them. Others going to morning zazen are counting on me to show up. When I realize that I too am relying on myself to show up, I can enter into a relationship with whatever is arising for me. True intimacy is created. So, when Guttai's attendant can enter into the experience of being with the moon, or the visceral experience of having his finger cut off and knowing there is no separation, he can experience the intimacy of unity. He can settle in. We can settle in. That's what I have. I don't know what time it is, but I'm assuming there's a lot of time for.
Yeah, we have a good 10 minutes or so for questions or comments.
So I would like to invite people, if people want to express a story or a transmission they receive from their mothers. That's one way to go. another way is to speak about something that began in the performative way that you were able to, that activity you were able to delve into, and things switched for you and a connection was made. So that's kind of my prompts, or anything else you might want to say.
What's authentic? What is authenticity?
Showing up. What do you think?
It's not discursive. Yeah, it is. It seems like it involves activity.
Oh, absolutely.
But I'm struck. This. I'm bothered by this example, because I don't trust people who think they know what's good for me a lot of the time. And you use performative in a way that I mean, my understanding of performative, it comes from higher ed. And it doesn't mean inauthenticity. It means to say something more about the truth, that much of the action we take is symbolic, but that's okay. When I christened the ship Bessie, it wasn't Bessie until I christened it so, right? And so there's nothing inauthentic in that performative utterance or statement. It's just more reflective of what is just true, you know, about language, and not getting fixed on our describing things. But the example you gave from the case, again, it's relational, it's the teacher and the student. In order to become an enlightened, to have that moment, the student has to undergo a violence, and their reactions to it and accept in order to pass through. But I'm stuck on the fact that what seems like the teacher's, I don't know, authority, the question of authority as it relates to it's troubling me here.
Well, it seems like you were recognizing this, the word performative.
You know, I'm sorry, would you restate the question maybe?
Oh, yeah. Okay, so what I feel I heard is that you're feeling like using the word performative as being inauthentic is a problem for you, and that also the teacher having an authority to do something violent to his student as a way of waking him up is problematic. Is that?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
And it rests in like the problem of the question of authority and trust for me.
Okay. Yeah. And so giving the teacher the authority to act in that way towards his student. Would you say that?
Sure.
Okay. So one thing with the word performative, I think it's different semantics and connotations, I believe. And so the way I was using performative, and I think the person in the study group was using it as, you know, perhaps showing up physically, but not really engaging with the activity. Because there are times we do that. We all do that. It's like we have to be someplace or do something, and perhaps I'm washing the dishes, and I'm not really into it, and I'm not paying attention, and the dishes are clanging around, and I drop a dish on the floor and it breaks, or something. Or a good example I would give is if I'm having a conversation with somebody, and I see somebody behind us walking, who I really want to talk to, my attention goes away. And so I'm kind of part of a conversation, but not engaged. And so in some way, there's a performative aspect of I need to be here to engage with somebody who's coming to clouds, and but I really want to talk to that person, you know. So it's the not being fully there in this in the context I was using is can be performative, or not as I think when we were speaking that it was like the particular Zen center was dropping all these different activities without really delving into what they are, and so letting go of them without actually exploring them. Like I said, like seeing a plate of food and not tasting. Is there more?
I have something more.
Okay.
I just want everyone to know in no uncertain terms that no teacher here at Clouds and Water will ever cut off a student's finger. Cut off a student's finger or do any other kind of violence like that. I mean, I think it's important to say.
Yes.
And I don't know if that really happened. Maybe it did.
Yeah, right. Right.
But the other thing, I'm thinking about authority and like the presumption of a teacher to, you know, like, okay, I know what you're thinking. I know that you're not really being authentic. That is a little bit of a problem. But also, I think just as human beings, we sometimes know that. And I'll just give a little example. When I was at Ryumonji, Zen Monastery for 3 weeks practice period, and one of the weeks it was just Shokan and I, the abbot, and so he said, well, how about I'll be the attendant and you can be the doshi, so lead the service. So as the attendant, he's offering me the incense and, you know, he's following me, so that, you know, and we've known each other a long time, it's fine. But anyway, one part he was giving me the incense and I was placing it, and he said, I can't remember, he said right then or later, but he said, do you know the gatha for offering incense? Or do you know there's a gatha for offering incense? And I said, yeah, I know it. But then I realized I wasn't saying it. So there's like a little verse, like a prayer, that you're supposed to like silently recite, which helps bring your attention. And I don't know. I mean, it could be that he was just in, but there were other times that I offered incense that he didn't say that. So I feel like my attention wasn't there, and he sensed it. So I think there's time, you can probably think of times when you're talking to someone and you get a sense that they're not really present. So I think that that can happen, but I think as teachers, we have to be very, very careful not to presume that we know. And I've gotten into trouble and I've hurt people by presuming that. So I'm really working on that, and I think we all are. But anyway, I just felt like I wanted to mention that dynamic. And
yes.
That's
good.
So thank you.
Now, can I say something about my mom?
Yeah, really. Let's change it.
Because this is an instance, a story where, and I knew it wasn't on me to be the authority, right? And it involves my son who got himself in trouble. At school, he was disrespectful to his principal, who was the assistant principal, who was a black woman, and he called her a name. Mm-hmm. And because I come from a culture where you don't mess with mama is sacred.
Yeah.
I went and picked him up from school, and I took him to my mom. Mm. And I just dropped him off. I gave her a warning while I was coming, and I dropped him off, and I left. Recently, I saw the principal, and she said, I don't know what happened, but I haven't had any trouble with since then. Mm. And I said, well, I took him to my mom. All I know is when I picked him up, she said, now remember what I told you. Mm. And then she said something about his mom. Think about your mom. Mm.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. You know, this, mine's a little segue, but I was thinking about performativity, you know, and how it gets kind of a bad rap, but it's so generative, because there are so many times when I'm doing something that is performative, that I'm reluctant or something, but in the moment of performing, right, something happens, and maybe, and I engage, and I come to the thing, and then then it feels authentic, you know. So I feel like being performative is, it's like uncertainty, you know, these ways of being that create spaces and openness. And I think we think of performative as like closed or something, but it's very open. And even a theater, like, you know, you're an actor, you come out and you perform, and just all the generation that is. So I was just thinking of performativity in a more positive, authentic way.
Thank you.
And that was a little bit about what my song is about.
Yes.
but also a thing, too, that sometimes we're putting ourselves in situations and putting ourselves in a container that's hopefully wholesome in some ways, that once we're in the container, and like Gutai saw that Zazen wasn't enough, that there was all this stuff in the world, and he needed to put himself in the world, and he waited for this teacher, and he was open to what the teacher had to say, and it changed his whole world. And so, yeah, I think that performative is, I think, necessary. And so, but performative with a touch of open-heartedness. Because if we're closed, performative can be stifling.
Yeah.
I feel sorry for you is performative. It's performative, but it's generative, as you say, because you got it. You got it connected in some way.
Yes. So, yeah, I was willing to look at what he was trying to convey to me. So there's a sample of my teacher seeing something. And he didn't cut off my fingers.
Right. Almost, but not.
The word that came to me on this is it's like a pivot place. So you're stepping in, and in that moment you're going to choose, like, engage more or start getting mad and feeling put upon, and these are my feelings, you know, and those are really killing it, that stinginess, you know.
Yes,
but
yes.
Then you said open, yeah.
Yes, thank you. I love that word, and I somehow missed it. Anyone else?
So I agree on the authority part. Mostly that is a struggle because someone who identifies as queer and has lived in very rural places and very conservative places, performative is mostly about safety, and it's not genuine, and it cannot be genuine. Mm-hmm. And so it is trying to excise those pieces that may be useful, and then letting go of those pieces that are not years later. And so that is a struggle, because you do internalize these practices, no matter what you do. Mm-hmm. And so how do you take what can be helpful and what is not, and try and dissect those? And that can be difficult.
when I was writing this talk, I can't think of the name of it, but Maya Angelou wrote this poem where she was smiling on the outside, but crying on the inside. Do you know the name of that?
Maya Kagebrook's saying, it's in response to Paul Laurence Dunbar's "We Wear the Mask." We wear the mask that grins and lies,
right,
hides our cheeks and shades our eyes. Isn't it? We pay to human guile with torn and bleeding hearts. We smile and cry of myriad subtleties. Why should the world be overwise in counting all our tears and sighs? Nay, let them only let them see us when we wear the mask. We, though, was a collective situation. But why the cage bird sings.
Ah, yes.
Or I know why the cage bird
sings. Yes, yes. I have to say, my 10th grade English teacher had us read that book. It was in 1973 or 74. And then the local newspaper had a book and author luncheon. And she took us to see Maya Angelou. Mm-hmm. Oh, wow. So when I was 16 years old, I got to see Maya Angelou from reading that book.
Wow, so nice.
Thank you for sharing that.
Okay, thank you very much, Yolan. I think we're about out of time.
Okay.